Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Reporter William Lobdell found his faith in a come-to-Jesus experience in 1992, found a born-again faith that helped him turn his life around and guided him in his work on the religion beat for the Los Angeles Times. He had that faith, he loved it, and he lost it. Now Lobdell is telling the story of his journey from God to atheism, and church leaders themselves are saying, listen up. This hour on Point, a journey into and out of faith. You can join the conversation. Have you found religion? Lost it? Why? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is William Lobdell, an award-winning journalist. He covered religion for the Los Angeles Times for 8 years. His new book is Losing My Religion, How I Lost My Faith Reporting on Religion in America and Found Unexpected Peace. Christianity Today chairman John Huffman calls it a must-read filled with warnings and wake-up calls for the faithful. Bill Lobdell, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
So are you one of the new angry atheists out there? We've talked with some in recent years. Have you joined those ranks, Bill?
I have not. I'm not an anti-theist. I'm a reluctant atheist.
A reluctant atheist. And I'm even reading you here in your one of your latest blog entries online saying, talking about, you say, the most arrogant people I meet are in general atheists. So it's, you're prickly in a couple of directions here.
Try to please everybody.
Tell us about the moment, the situation that took you at, what, age 27, 28, to religious faith in a burst.
Yeah, you know, I had, my life was a wreck. A friend of mine sat down with him and he said, you know what, you need God in your life. And at the time he could have said crack cocaine and I would have taken it. I was just in that much pain. And he took me to church and eventually ended up at a religious retreat in the mountains. And at the end of that weekend, being really emotionally vulnerable and kind of worn down, I had this born-again experience where I literally felt Jesus come into my heart, and I felt this warm glow and tingling, and it was, you know, I thought this great born-again experience that would change my life.
And it wasn't just that moment. It wasn't just that day. It wasn't over when Amazing Grace stopped playing. You were serious about it. We're deep in the fold of a evangelical church for a while, migrated onto Presbyterian, I think, then began to dabble with Catholicism after your Episcopalian childhood. This wasn't just the movement of a moment, or was it? If you would have taken crack cocaine just as easily, was this a serious engagement with religious faith?
No, it was very serious. I had really changed my life around. I got into Bible studies. All my reading changed to Christian apologetics, Christian classics, the Bible. I prayed morning, noon, and night. And my life did change around. I got on the straight and narrow, and I was a journalist, and I was looking in the how the mainstream media would treat religion. And then I saw what the stories that were going on in my faith community and others, and there was just a big gap. The mainstream media treated faith at the time, and this is in general, sort of like a freak show. You know, they would go to kind of nutballs, I think, like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson. They'd talk endlessly about abortion or homosexuality, but I was seeing these incredible stories, dramatic stories within my community, and I thought, maybe God wants me to be a religion writer. And so that's when I started praying for that.
You prayed for it, it came to you, and at that time you believed it was the result of your religious faith, of your prayers.
Yeah, it was sort of a series of miraculous events that led me to become the religion writer for the Times, or a religion writer for the Times, and I did think it was the answer to my prayers, and for the first couple of years, it was. I had the best job in the world. It deepened my faith. I just thought God was an amazing God, and this is exactly where He wanted me, and I loved everything about it.
And you wrote about religion, religious communities from many different angles, many different kinds of communities. During that time, though,
This is when you were in the fold, in the faith. You were also migrating a lot. Why was that? Why did you migrate from the born-again community to the Presbyterian and then toward Catholicism? What was up with that?
Well, I entered back into the Christian faith through a mega church Southern California, and it was very seeker friendly. And as a result, I felt after I got sort of the initial basics down, it was fairly shallow in its theology, and I was always looking for something a little more with a little more depth to it. And I went to the Presbyterian church because I knew the pastor there. It had a little more heft to it, but I really felt myself eventually I would end up at the one true church, the Catholic Church.
When you were making this migration, did you keep this sense of a personal God that you had with the born-again experience, a personal God who loved you perfectly, who loved you personally?
Very much so. I would have called myself a evangelical Presbyterian, and I think if I ended up going into the Catholic Church, I would have called myself an evangelical Catholic.
But before you really came a Catholic association, it began to fall away. And it's striking that you've still got people out there in that community. Maybe anyone would, but you've still got a lot of friends in the religious community, a lot of them sort of hoping for you, praying for you as you write, also taking lessons from your book. I'm looking here, Richard, was it Mao at the Fuller Theological Seminary, president there, saying this is not another new atheism blast. He says it's a moving story about a quest for faith that brought him, you, to a point of disillusionment. And he says it's an important honesty check for our own journeys, by which he means, I guess, other Christians. What do they say to you? What were you saying to them as things began to slip? Or were you able to talk about your doubts when you were in the fold?
Well, that's one of the problems. Doubt is not a valued commodity within the Christian community, serious doubt. And so I did have friends. I did talk to them, but, you know, they always said, you know, why don't you pray some more? Why don't you read the Bible more? Things that really didn't help very much. And so I couldn't, it took me about 4 years to actually come to terms with and admit that I'd lost my faith, because it was such a part of me for almost 20 years that I just couldn't imagine my life anything but a believer. And even though I had lost my faith when I look back on it long, long before, I just couldn't bring myself to admit that I was one of those big, bad atheists.
What made you lose it?
Well, it started with a Catholic sex scandal. I was taking classes to become a conversion classes to become a Catholic at night and on the weekends, and during the daytime I was working full time on the Catholic sex scandal and talking to sexual abuse victims, talking to bishops who were lying to me, talking to their lawyers who were lying to me. And I led this sort of dual life where I didn't think these two paths would cross. I thought that the Catholic hierarchy had corruption within it, and it's had in the past, and it will in the future. And I didn't really see that as a threat to my faith. And I saw this in my conversion classes as this very pure church with this great tradition and these great people. And then, really, about a week before I was going to go into the church, I got a tip that this pastor was going to have to step down because he was admitted child molester, and he got in the pulpit. And he told the people that what had happened. He gave sort of a victim speech and said he had a boundary violation 19 years ago with a minor, which boundary violation is a great euphemism. Mm. And I'm a father of four, so I was sitting in the back of the church. And
four sons.
Four sons. Mm-hmm. And I was very curious. I was personally outraged that they'd have an admitted child molester to be pastor of this church. And this is, you know, the start of this scandal. And he steps down off the pulpit, and they rise up and give him a standing ovation like it's, you know, game 7 of the NBA finals, and tears are pouring down people's face and they're cheering him. And I'm thinking, this guy's an admitted child molester, and they're worshiping him. And then later on the parish hall, they had like a debriefing session there, and the congregation wanted to name their parish hall after him to honor their good pastor. And that made me think, man, I mean, there's such a there's such a disconnect between between people, their what they say their faith is, and their ability to sort of worship this priest and ignore the victim. And I just decided at that point that I couldn't go in the Catholic Church at that time.
You couldn't go into the Catholic Church, but that's not all you left. You ended up walking away from Christianity entirely.
Yeah, eventually those type of stories really started to put some dents in my faith, and people say that I'm mixing up the sinfulness of man with a perfect God, and it was the sinfulness of man that put some doubts into my faith. But really what happened over the course of, well, two things happened. One, the sex scandal showed me that I was a very good investigative reporter, and luckily for me on the faith beat, or unluckily, it depends on how you look at it, there's no shortage of scandals and hypocrisy. And so while my professional life started to soar and I got all these great stories, I was just seeing, just the worst of the underbelly of religion. And so as I felt my faith slipping away, I tried very, very hard to hold on to it. And I went around trying to gather evidence that my faith was true. And one of the things, just for example, is I thought, well, I'm a journalist. I can figure out if my faith is true, if Christianity is true, behavior of Christians should be better than behavior of atheists. And I found very quickly that there's no study that shows that the behavior is any different.
William Lobdell is with us. His new book is Losing My Religion, How I Lost My Faith, Reporting on Religion in America and Found Unexpected Peace. He came into born-again faith to the tune of Amazing Grace. Now he's out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about finding faith and losing it in America with journalist William Lobdell. He came born again into Christian faith in 1992. By 2007, he was out. Long and hard journey that he's writing about now as an atheist. His new book is Losing My Religion. Bill, we've got a lot of people who'd like to speak with you. Let me begin to turn to them. Let's go to Petal, Mississippi, and Phil. Phil, you're on the air with Bill Lobdell.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Phil.
Belief in God requires that word, quote-unquote, faith, which, when you're talking in a religious sense, means that it's blind faith. It's faith in something that you can't touch, you can't prove with science. It's non-quantifiable. It is simply what you believe. And morals have nothing to do with it, according to the New Testament. Being a good man, being a moral man, doesn't get you to paradise, to heaven. And the only thing from a Christian standpoint is to accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior and then do the best that you can to live your life as Jesus tells us we're supposed to. Now, does that mean that it's always easy? No, it doesn't. I don't know, man. It's one of those things where whenever Judgment Day comes, we're going to find out who was right. And it may have been the Hare Krishnas. Maybe it takes selling flowers in airports to get to heaven.
Phil, maybe. Hang on. Let me put it to Bill Lobdell. Bill, there's a response from Petal, Mississippi, to your story, saying, come on, religion's beyond proof. Born-again Christianity, beyond even morality. You went into heaven. You know what you'd have to do. And right on down. What do you say, Bill?
Two things. One is obviously to believe there has to be a leap of faith. When the leap is the Grand Canyon, that's one thing. If it's a small little creek, that's another. And for me, it became this Grand Canyon. The other thing is that I used to believe that faith was a choice, and I think I know now that's not true. If it's something that's deep inside you, and you have it or you don't. And if you don't, there's nothing you can do to sort of regenerate. It's like being in love. You can't like force yourself to be in love with someone. And I don't think you could force yourself to have faith if you don't have it.
But what about Phil's critique on the marriage? Is it, in a way, he's suggesting you're misunderstanding the faith that you had. This is beyond proof. This is you can't judge this by whether or not members of the faith behave better or worse. It's there's a personal relationship. I mean, you seem to once have it, this on your knees moment where you said, "I invite Jesus into my heart," and you say, "My heart opened into halves. A warm, glowing light flowed right in. I felt instantly the light was Jesus." In that moment, you weren't evaluating as a critical journalist. Maybe you were in that moment closer to what Phil's talking about.
No, I definitely was. But at some point, not even gathering the evidence, at some point that light switch went off. It went on in me, and it went off of me. And it's hard to sort of quantify why that happened and do a deep analysis of it. But it's something that's deep inside each person. And what I'm finding out, and one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is that a lot of people have these doubts, and a lot of people have these questions. But there you have these angry atheists that are sort of in one extreme, and then you've got the Christians that are trying to keep you in the fold. But there isn't anybody sort of in the middle saying, "Hey, this happened to me, and I can be I'm okay with it." And a lot of people go through this.
You now say that you're finding peace, not just an alternative to faith or an absence of faith, but peace through atheism. How does that work? To people of faith, that may sound like an oxymoron, a contradiction in terms.
Yeah, I've always been tortured by sort of the basic questions that people have who are believers, like why do bad things happen to good people? And once I realized that there came to the conclusion, for me at least, that there's no personal God that's going to come and intervene in my life, then it doesn't matter if a little kid gets sick and dies of a brain tumor like my guitar teacher's kid did. That's hard to explain when you're someone. You can't explain it if you're someone of faith. You just say that's one of God's mysteries. We'll find out later. But when you stop believing and wishing something else, you just say, "Well, it's that's the way nature works. That's just life." And it's caused me to live each day much more fully because I don't have that eternity to fall back on anymore. I have to just grab each day and get the most out of it because I feel very, very lucky to be alive in this little sliver of time in our universe, and I want to make the most of it.
Let's go to Diana in Brookline, Massachusetts. It's Phil and Petal. Thanks for calling, Phil. Diana, you're on the air. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you see, Diana?
Well, okay. I was sexually abused as a child. My parents were both professed atheists by religious background. One was Jewish, one was Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that I was abused by lots and lots of people.
Related to faith or not? Related.
So here's my point. In a sexual abuse recovery group, I was talking with people, and part of it is having God's in charge, having God help us with our life. And so people kept saying to me, he was saying just now about you have it or you don't.
Mm.
That's not my experience. My experience is people said to me, "Okay, turn this thing over. Turn the
right.
phone bill over to God.
Mm.
Turn whether or not I get to work on time over to God, whether or not I find a parking place over to God." That's actually a good starter one, the parking ferry. Find a parking place.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is over time, as I turn things over to God, well, either I get what I thought I wanted or I don't. Frequently, when I didn't get it, I would see how it's better. Sometimes I wouldn't. Sometimes I don't know. I don't know how things work. And in fact, I talked a lot about how I'm supposed to turn my will and my life over to the care of God when I know for a fact that I'm going to die. Everyone I love is going to die. And so somehow I have to way around that.
So are you in the fold of faith or out at this point, Diana? Is religion still important to you or not?
Well, so I guess here's my distinction. Yes, I am religious in the extent that I believe in God, and I believe that God runs my life, and I pray every day, and I turn things over every day, and I'm turning things over more because actually the God runs your life is extremely exciting because you never know what's going to happen next. But I mean, I guess part of the reason I really wanted to call is, you know, yes, sexual abuse is a horrible thing, and horrible things do happen, but that doesn't change, at least for me, that when I turn my life over to the care of God, my life goes better. And the more I turn my life over to God, the more it goes better. So just because there are religious people I have trouble with, God is still there, and God still helps me.
For you. Diana, thanks very much. Bill, what do you say?
Well, I like that job that of her God, where if things happen, that's great. If things don't happen, that's great too. That was one of my problems with my faith, is that when I'd pray, you know, I was told, well, if you get the answer you want, praise God. And if you don't get the answer you want, you got to praise God too. And it seems too simple for me.
But, I mean, here's another comment on the same line off our website from Paul in Wisconsin, asking you, why did you let the actions of men separate you from God? Our churches and the people that make them up are all fallible humans, Paul says.
Yeah, that's true. And again, that put some doubt in me, and it caused me to do this search to see if my faith was true. And I started this quest very much just wanted to shore up my faith. But everywhere I turned to, it pointed in the opposite direction. For example, there's no evidence at all that intercessory prayer works. It's in fact, the latest study shows that if you're in the hospital, you have a heart condition, you know a bunch of people are praying for you, you actually do more poorly because you have that tension and that stress that you need to get better because all these people are praying for you. And those type of studies, to me, when I look at them in a critical way, prayer should work. There should be some evidence that thousands of prayers going up would change people's lives. But there's just nothing there.
You're a tough customer. I mean, you want a kind of scientific proof. You want a prayer and somebody popping up out of bed. But millions have faith and don't require that. It's just interesting that you do.
Yeah, I think there should be some sort of shred of proof that, as I said earlier, that Christians act better than atheists, just a little bit, or that there's some evidence that prayer works, or there's a simple website, but it's called Why Does God Hate Amputees? And the premise is, if God can do anything, why doesn't he regenerate a limb of amputees? What does he have against those people? And you can extend that to, why doesn't he cure Lou Gehrig's disease or a long-term quadriplegic? And these things just don't happen. And why is that? Is it because God puts these people off to the side for some reason? Or is it because there isn't a God that answers those prayers?
Let's go to Newburyport, Massachusetts, and John. John, you're on the air with William Lobdell.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, John?
I just have one quick point to make. I think it's fairly naive to expect that there should be a difference between the actions of Christians and the actions of non-Christians. Because if you look at the history of Western civilization, the ethics and the morals of Christianity have sort of infiltrated society as a large. And so, in a very real sense, non-Christians behave in a Christian way. For example, the Golden Rule, you know, treat others as you would be treated. It has spread. The idea has spread beyond Christian society. So, you know, that differential has decreased.
It's a great observation. Bill Abdel, how about it? You're being too literal here, says John. Look around. Even if some of the aspects of what you read or what you saw didn't suit you or even revolted you, there's a net positive impact from faith that's bled out beyond its borders. What do you say?
Yeah, most people would argue the opposite, that the secular society has infiltrated Christianity, and that's why there's no difference between Christians and atheists. I think that the Golden Rule, I don't think that originated with the Christians. I think you can go to almost any civilization and that rule's in place, and I think it's part of the DNA of human beings just to survive and get along.
But let me ask you this. When you were 27, 28, and you were way down on your luck, and things were going really badly, I mean, you could barely lift yourself up in front of the mirror and stare yourself in the face in those days. And
correct.
Lots of people come to moments like that all around the world, and without a doubt, in this country. I mean, at that moment, you know, if it hadn't been religious faith, what was there for you? What is there for other people? I mean, I was raised deep in the church. It's been a long journey since then, but I've got born again relatives, and all of them came to it in a similar way, through a kind of path through crisis. And I asked myself, if that hadn't been there for them, you may like it or not like it, you know, belong to it or not belong to it, but in our society, if that weren't there for them, communities that reached out, that picked them up, that held them up, what would be there? What would have been there for you?
Well, I think it'd be, first of all, I think it's good that the church was there for me, and I appreciate it. And I think churches do amazing things. They do amazing good, amazing bad. I'm not, again, like an anti-atheist that thinks, you know, religion is this horrible plague on our society. But I do think one of the problems with the new atheist movement is that they haven't developed sort of alternatives to the churches where you can get the fellowship, you can get the care, you can get the love that churches give. And I think that's one of the challenges they're going to have going forward is how do they attract people like myself, let's say 20 years ago, where I was in need of something, you know, desperately, and the church was the one place that could provide it.
But isn't that an awful lot to write off, Bill, you know, to say that they haven't come up with that? But that's not coming up with a lot. I mean, I remember growing up as a kid sort of developing the sense that, you know, there was a world full of love out there. I developed that in the, you know, in church basements at fellowship halls and potluck dinners where everybody would tousle your hair and, lucky for me, never abused. And it, on the contrary, it sort of created a worldview that there's a community of love out there. Without that church, where would I or any kid today, where would they get that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think that's the role that the church plays, and I think there's a vacuum there if the church isn't there.
But isn't that an argument for maintaining, sustaining, encouraging faith? I mean,
but if it's based on a, in my point of view, if it's based on a fairy tale, that's a little bit silly to continue along those lines. That it's based on something that's not true, even though it does a lot of great good. Do you continue it? I don't know.
What about with your sons? You have four children. I mean, I remember when I first had kids, you know, and they began to grow up, and I thought, how am I going to give them a sense of, you know, the majesty and the mystery of life without, I mean, of course, you know, I read them Everything Under the Sun and all the poems and all the great, you know, works for children, but still, there's a kind of a cosmic breadth suggested in religious faith that's hard to communicate any other way. How do you deal with that?
Well, for a long time, I did what most dads would do, is I ignored the issue, didn't talk to them about it. Eventually, I did tell them where I was. And they looked at me and they said, "Well, we knew this. We stopped going to church. We're not dumb." Mm. But I think the world, you know, with God or without God, is an incredibly complex, miraculous, beautiful place. And I don't think you need God in that equation to make it any more or less than it is.
Let's go to Bob in East Lansing, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's actually Barb.
Barb, excuse me.
I wanted to call and echo the sentiment that faith is not a choice, based on my own experience, which is I would not have considered myself to be a particularly religious person, but I had very deep spiritual beliefs. And during the illness of my father, I know that I prayed many, many, many times a day and believed that my grandparents were watching over me from heaven and had some real traditional types of beliefs. And then when my father died, I completely lost my faith. Really, I feel against my will. I just couldn't make any rational sense anymore. It wasn't an anger thing. I just, as the years have gone on, I just can no longer make any sense of the idea that there's a heaven or a hell or anybody that's watching over us. It seems to me like a really primitive kind of belief, and I find myself wondering how anyone can believe in it. So, I guess
Barbara, I've got a break right here, but we appreciate your story, your witness. We'll look at it. We're talking with, thank you very much, Barb, for calling. William Lobdell is with us. His new book is Losing My Religion. We'll go out with Lord, I Lift Your Name on High, the kind of song that he sang, praise song, when he was deep in the faith. Now he's out of it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking today about finding faith and losing it. And One Lifetime. That is William Lobdell's story. He's written it up in a new book, Losing My Religion, How I Lost My Faith, Reporting on Religion in America, and Found Unexpected Peace. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow William Lobdell at his blog at williamlobdell.com. He was at the LA Times reporting on religion and the religious communities there. He's now a visiting faculty member at the University of California, Irvine, where he teaches a course on religion and the media. Lots of callers in Nashville, Tennessee. Jason, you're on the air with Bill Lobdell.
Hi, Tom and William. Tom, great show. And William, I'm looking forward to reading your book. I have a very similar journey, and I was raised as a Christian and a lover of God. I went to church, affectionately I refer to as Fort God, and had many great experiences there. In college, went to a Presbyterian church to put some meat onto my faith, and soon after that, I started realizing if the Bible was the foundation of the faith, then I needed to know more about that. Went through that, and ended up in the Catholic Church. Very similar journey, and then once again kind of was deflated with this whole sex scandal.
So where do you stand now, Jason? Where are you now?
Well, yeah, the reality is I guess I never met Jesus, and so how could I possibly yield the status of my soul to someone I've never met? I'm still open, and I'm still praying. I feel now, though, that I'm more free to love God in that, in turn. You know, God the Father, the God of Abraham, makes sense to me somehow.
So do you have a faith or not?
Say again?
Do you have a faith then?
Absolutely. I have a faith in God the Father, the God of Abraham, the one that binds us to this great tradition.
Is it a Christian faith at this point?
I'm open to that. As I said again, I've never met Jesus, and that's the point of, I guess, the point of truth and the point of, well, when I realized I needed to be honest with myself, that's the point I got. I haven't really met Jesus. I'm open to him, but something just doesn't add up.
You're talking Abraham. Are you going back up the root system to Judaism? Where are you headed here, Jason?
Absolutely. It makes the most sense at this point.
Interesting. William Lobdell, there you go. Born again and a Presbyterian and Catholic and maybe next Jewish. Now, you hear Jason in Nashville. He's still following the trail. It's the trail of faith. He hasn't hopped off to atheism. Does that make his journey different from yours, Bill?
It does. You know, at some point, I came to the conclusion that I had to stop wishing what was true and start facing what was true for me. And that was that that I wasn't on the religious trail anymore, and that I'd fallen off it long ago.
You reported on a lot of different faiths as religion writer for the LA Times. How did that, looking, you know, up over the rim and out at faiths other than Christianity, how did that affect your view of faith and religion?
You know, I saw man's fingerprints all over every faith, and didn't see a lot of God's. I did see from time to time, but I didn't think any faith was much different than Christianity in its man-centric ways. And I think people who, and I think most of the people see that, and so they don't. I was always admiring people that are on the far left and far right of their faith, because those people acted as though their scriptures were true. They really acted out their faith. And then there's this kind of squishy middle that I'd call them in Christianity sort of these cultural Christians that were raised in the church, like to go to church, like the activities there, but don't act as though the gospels are true.
And what about the hunger? Maybe, I mean, I keep coming back to this, but you quote the Psalms here, you know, as the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, O God. I mean, it's beautiful just as poetry, but it speaks to a hunger that humans have known forever, I guess. What do you do with that?
Yeah, I think that there is. For me, if for some reason I was able to close the loop on that. I think I was hungry for, you know, I needed a perfect father that would love me no matter what I did. He couldn't love me any more or any less. He just loved me perfectly. I love the idea of heaven and being, you know, in heaven for eternity with him. So that was sort of that longing. Once that was out of the equation, it sort of closed up the loop. And that you know, I thought there'd be a, as they always talk about, the hole in the heart. I thought there'd be a hole in my heart, but there hasn't been. It's been sort of the opposite. It's been filled in.
But you do write that when you left the faith, that you had a sort of whole new set of problems that burst in front of you.
Yeah. Well, I had. I had a number of friends, for example, that weren't thrilled with my new life. Most of my Christian friends stayed with me, but a lot of them didn't. I had a brother-in-law who came to me and said, the reason why my son got type 1 diabetes is because I lifted God's protection from my house and let Satan in. And
because you had done that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There were other challenges, but I felt sort of a freedom. My behavior didn't change. I didn't, you know, go crazy and do whatever I wanted to. I think I'm still bound by what I feel is like inherent in every human being, no matter what their faith or lack of faith is.
You're right. You said my biggest challenge was death. Never the most comfortable subject. It now terrified me. My afterlife was an abyss.
Yeah, that was a hard one to get over. I'm not sure I'm quite over it yet. But it's hard to think that, you know, when I die, there's nothing left. I think that if I were to start a religion that said, you know what, when you die, you die and that's it. And there's no loving father to look after you. And come on and follow me. Let's start a new religion. I don't think that would work. I think that for me, that idea of that perfect father in the heaven was one of the main draws to Christianity. And so I had to get over that. And I've sort of just think that now that when I die, it's going to be like before I was born. I don't think there's any consciousness. I don't think there's, I just think that's it. And if I'm wrong, I hope I'm wrong. I hope there's a great afterlife, but I don't think so.
You wrote about the famous mega church preacher and far beyond, Rick Warren, out of California, read by what, hundreds of thousands, millions, super best-selling writer about...
I think 32 million or
32
so.
32 million, okay, big time. We saw him interview John McCain and Barack Obama during the presidential campaign. Your friend Hugh Hewitt, who's a Christian conservative, a radio show host in California, talked about your book with Rick Warren, and you know, talking about the new atheism and the attention that it's getting. And Pastor Rick Warren's first response was to say, "Well, in the first place, they're making a ton of money, okay." And then he went on to say that he's never known an atheist who wasn't mad, who wasn't angry. The sort of the notion that you must be sort of congenitally angry or wounded somehow. What do you make of those points from Pastor Rick Warren?
Well, it's funny. I get some of that criticism that you've just written this book because you're trying to make money off of God or off of Christianity. And I've never seen any Christian say, hey, he's for Christian authors saying, hey, they're just trying to make money off of God.
Rick Warren with his 32 million copies out there.
Yeah, no, Rick Warren, I mean, he's paid back his entire salary for 20 years to the church, and he reverse tithes, meaning he gives 90% away to charity. Mm-hmm. So he's done a good job in that mm-hmm. respect. But I think that's a silly criticism. The other, what was the other one? Oh, well, the angry.
Angry, wounded.
You know, there are a lot of angry atheists out there, because I think a lot of them have been wounded by religion, and they're kind of fed up with the reason why we have this new atheist movement in America is because of the it's on the wane now, I think, but the influence of the religious right on politics, and atheists like to, for the most part, just to be left alone, and they have throughout history just been quiet until they were kind of pushed into a corner. I feel like the Hitchens and the Dawkins books that have mm-hmm. come out is because they felt pushed into a corner and they're going to lash back out. And so there are a lot of angry atheists, but you know what? There's a lot of nice, normal atheists like myself who don't have this seething anger at the church or religious leaders.
Let's go to Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. Great show. I love it. I was born in Soviet Union and raised complete atheist to a set of atheist parents.
Mm-hmm.
I still have all my morals. I'm not angry at the world. I live good life. I'm raising child myself. I'm not indoctrinating him at all with religion. I think it should be his own choice of what he wants to do. It's up to me, actually, to show him, you know, what life and morals are all about and lead him on a good path, but not via religious path.
So you never had it, you don't have it, and you in that circumstance, don't feel a vacuum, an absence.
Absolutely. I actually feel liberated, if you can imagine that.
Oh.
I've tried a little bit with Judaism when I was there, and it was completely, it was kind of under covers, but it was just a play, you know?
Yep. Michael, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. I want to get a couple more in here, if I may. Thank you, Michael. Fred in Gary, New Hampshire. You're on the air, Fred.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to mention that I'm glad I found God. It was in a church, but it was in a church basement, a pretty desperate 20-something-year-old in an AA meeting.
Yep.
And it kind of bums me out when I hear about folks who lose their faith because they had found God in one structured religion, and then, well, if there's not a God in that particular realm that I'm being taught, then there's no God. I would just hope that to, you know, believe in a higher power, if you will, or someone to be a deist. I just wanted to throw that out there for people that it ain't black and white, but I'm enjoying your conversation.
Fred, thank you very much. Bill Abdo, how about it? I mean, you've called yourself an atheist during this hour in many cases, but I've also seen you throw around a little deism, sort of the perspective of, I don't know, maybe like a Thomas Jefferson on the world. What do you say to Fred's observation?
Yeah, I think that what I really believe is that there's not a God that intervenes personally into this world. For me, that's sort of the big distinction, whether there's a creator that kicked this whole thing out and has a hands-off perspective, or there's no God at all. I don't think those differences seem to be minor to me.
You've got Mary here online saying, why don't you become a Unitarian if you're having trouble with the faith in the Supreme Being?
Yeah, Unitarianism is for me like drinking a non-alcoholic beer. I think what's the point? It's they don't really believe it a whole lot. I love Unitarian churches. They have me speak all the time, but it's sort of like being with church with no God and or maybe a God or, you know, who knows what. I'm not attracted to that.
Mary, there's a tough one to catch here. Let's go to Kim in Clinton, New Jersey. Kim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm really excited about this book. I can't wait to get it and read it. I was raised in an area where everyone was religious, and I was too as a young person. But it seems as I grow older, I just find it magical thinking, I suppose, and I really wish I could still believe it, but I just can't bring myself to swallow it. And I miss the comfort of religion, so I'm hoping I can find some comfort in this book.
Kim, we appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Our time is short. Let's get one more here from Warwick, Rhode Island, and Karen. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say I am a CCD teacher. I'm a religious teacher for first graders.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that I like to point out to the kids is that, you know, God is a loving father, but just like a regular father or parent, you know, your prayers are always answered. Sometimes God says no, and you have to recognize that he's not always going to answer in the way that you want things to be answered, and that what he basically does for us is he just gives us the strength to get through the times where he does say no. I know it's difficult, but That's one of the things that I was taught, and,
It's a good perspective, Karen. Our time is short. William Lobdell, maybe you just ask too much. Sometimes you pray, and the answer is no.
Maybe God's been telling me no all this time. I understand that thinking. I just don't believe it.
You know, I still come back to the powerful image earlier in the book of you at 27, 28. I mean, we didn't go into all the details here, but it was pretty rough. You were in bad, bad shape. And though you've walked away from it now, you know, here was the institution in our society that buoyed you up in that time. If it weren't for that, what is out there? Should government do that? If we were a nation of atheists,
no,
front to, well, who? No. Well, who? What? I mean, is it going to be bowling leagues that do that? Is it going to be union halls? I mean, what is it? Who is it? How is it that when we fall down in life, and we do, you may be right, but I'm still curious about the utility. What steps in?
I think what you're going to find is as we in this, we are becoming a less Christian nation, and more people are either coming out of the closet and saying they're atheists, or these cultural Christians are saying, hey, you know, I really don't believe this. There will be organizations, atheist organizations, and along those lines that will fill the vacuum. And there's a couple I've spoke to a couple of atheist groups that are already doing this. They have their singles night, and they have their hikes up to the mountains, and they have their AA groups, but it's not the traditional 12-step program, because that's God-based.
And what's the saving message in that case for that floundering human being? It's not there's a great deity that loves you. It's what, there's a cool scientific universe out there, and you can stand up and stride forward in it.
Exactly. You have power over you have power over your own life, and you have people who love you, and we'll get you through this. You don't need to surrender everything, and you're not this helpless person, but you're someone that can pick yourself up by your bootstraps, and we'll help you.
You make it clear in the book and beyond that a lot of your friends from the Christian community are still trying to throw a lasso around you and get you back into faith, assuming you will come back to the faith. Will you? What do you think?
I don't think so. I think if prayer works, I will, because I've got a lot of people praying for me, but I don't think I'll be back.
William Lobdell, it's quite a story. We thank you for sharing it. It's an intimate sharing. The new book is Losing My Religion, How I Lost My Faith, Reporting on Religion in America and Found Unexpected Peace. William Lobdell joined us today from Culver City, California. Bill, thanks a lot. Good luck to you.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll go out with John Lennon and his song, God. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And so